glad if you would come back and say, well, thank you.
And just pause this morning. We're here today because the 13th Court of Appeals sitting in Corpus Christi denied Mr. Garcia's motion for extension of time to file his cost bond and dismissed the appeal for want of jurisdiction. The reason for filing the cost bond after the expiration of the 30-day deadline, which necessitated the motion for extension of time, was essentially my decision and was based upon my determination that it was not appropriate nor authorized to file an appeal until after I had reviewed the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Now, what in the rules would make you think that was appropriate or authorized?
Basically, beginning with the new Rule 13, Your Honor. New Rule 13 says an attorney shall not file any paper until, to the best of his knowledge and information and belief, formed after reasonable inquiry, the instrument is not groundless. Okay? Now, I am at a loss to understand how an attorney would make reasonable inquiry into whether or not he had reasonable grounds for an appeal without having the trial court's reasons, not only factual and conclusive, legally, as to the basis for the judgment.
What was the underlying suit about? And I'm trying to get a feel for how much difference the findings and conclusions would make.
Basically, Your Honor, the underlying case involved a contract between Mr. Garcia and Kastner Farms, where Mr. Garcia was to excavate material from a pit, a borrow pit, and transfer that material to a reservoir being built by Kastner Farms. The contract was based upon the amount of material that was removed from the pit. Okay? The basic facts in that situation were that the pit was filled in before Mr. Garcia had an independent ability to verify the amount of material that had actually been removed from the pit. Mr. Garcia had trucking tickets that showed he had removed about 50,000 cubic yards. Mr. Kastner had surveys that showed approximately 30,000 cubic yards had been removed. There was a 20,000 cubic yard discrepancy as to the amount of material that had been removed. The trial court in this case found there was also an issue early in the negotiations. The trucks were being stopped, not only Mr. Garcia's trucks but his subcontracted trucks were being stopped. They were all within weight limit and being loaded, but they were not weight limit along the actual loads. So they had to start reducing the amount of material that they were carrying. This was negotiated with the Kastners. The Kastners agreed to pay them an additional amount per cubic yard. Basically, the trial court then found the amount of material that had been removed, and also found that the amount that the contract itself, well, as I say, the judgment strictly recited that Mr. Kastner was entitled to X number of dollars for hauling the material that had been unpaid. Kastner Farms was entitled to an offsetting damages for its damages that it had suffered, with no explanation of what those were, for X amount of money. My attorney's fees were offset against Mr. Witten's attorney's fees.
But you're telling us that the findings could have been written in such a way that you felt you would have no reasonable grounds for appeal, or they could have been written in such a way that you felt you would have had a reasonable ground.
I felt like it was a mandate that I was required to make a reasonable inquiry. I thought that was mandated, not, you know, in truth and in fact, I probably had decided that it was probably reasonable to appeal it. However, I believe that the rules mandated that I review those findings and fact and conclusions of law to have reasonable inquiry into what those were before I appealed, perfected the appeal. Not only that, Your Honor, I believe that this basic attorney professionalism requires that you advise your client as to the reasonability of an appeal, taking into effect everything else. I mean, the expense of an appeal, the court's times, the delay, and everything else. Whereas an appeal may not be groundless and for bad faith, I believe an attorney has a reasonable not a reasonable, an obligation to his client to say, yes, you have a reasonable grounds for this appeal, and therefore you should proceed with this appeal, or no, you should not proceed with this appeal. And I'm not sure, and I don't know how that can be done without having the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law.
What if he had not filed findings and conclusions?
Well, Your Honor, under that situation, and the law in this area is somewhat confused, but there is a presumption of error at that point. Then I would have been entitled to go to the Court of Appeals and say the trial court had not issued findings of fact and conclusions of law after I had requested them, after I properly notified the court of its findings of fact and conclusions of law. There is case law to the fact that that is presumed to be error on its face, and you're entitled to a new trial.
What if he had just delayed further? Delayed past the time under the rules to file the findings and conclusions?
That's what I'm saying. Under those scenarios, there is case law to the effect out of the Houston court that says there's an old line of cases, and it's recently, I believe it's at least as recent as 1987, the 14th court said, in that situation, there is a presumption of error.
And they're just late.
Excuse me?
If they're just late.
Well, the rules of procedure give the trial court 30 days to file them. Then the attorney for the appellant in this case is required to remind the trial court and give the trial court a reminder that it has not filed them within the 30-day period of time. The trial court has an additional 5 days in which to file the findings of fact and conclusions of law.
But if he takes 60 and ultimately files them, unless it works some prejudice to the appellant, the findings will be considered on appeal. Is that true or not?
As I'm submitting to you, Justice Heck, there is a conflict amongst the various courts of appeals on this issue. The 14th Court of Appeals says that is a presumption of error. If the trial court does not issue findings of fact and conclusions of law, it is presumed erroneous and the appellant is entitled to a new trial on its face. There is also a line of cases that says, wait a minute, the Court of Appeals in this situation, once the appeal is perfected, abates the appeal until and goes back and essentially mandates the trial court to issue findings of fact and conclusions of law. So exactly what happens, as I say, I tell you at this point, it is confused. It was not an issue in this case, since the trial court did finally issue its findings of fact and conclusions of law. But the point is, what happens at that point, again, I'll submit to this court is confused, but there is a line of authority that says the appellant is automatically at that point entitled to a new trial under the presumption of error rule.
Well, is it fair to say that you knew your time was running and you looked at what you thought was the applicable rules and law and decided that you should wait?
Yes.
So that if the test is whether the delay was deliberate, the failure to file was deliberate, then you're going to lose.
Yes, but there is precedent before this court that mistake, mischance, and inadvertence are not the only. There are a long line of cases and accepted cases where the failure to file was deliberate. Now, I'd also like to say that Rule 41A seems to resolve this dilemma that you're talking about with the 15-day grace period, and I'd like to kind of illustrate the time factors because this is one of the things that I consider in making this determination. The findings of fact were due June 9, 1988 in this case, which was 30 days after the judgment was signed. Again, of course, the cost bond was due at that same time. When the findings of fact were not issued on that date, a reminder was due within 5 days of that date, which would have been due on June 14, 1988. This was brought to the attention of the court on June 13, 1988. Now, the trial court would have had until June 18, 1988 to file its findings of fact and conclusions of law. But Mr. Garcia would have had until the 24th after that in order to file his cost bond and still be within the 15-day extension. So I was under the assumption and believed that this was what it was intended to do. The 15-day extension runs you past the time that the trial court is mandated to file its findings of fact and conclusions of law and therefore resolve this issue and essentially eliminated the dilemma. Now, the trial court actually signed its findings, in fact, and conclusions of law on June 14th, 88. I received notice on that of June 17th, filed the extension for time the following Monday. June 17th was a Friday, filed it on Monday the 20th. Cross bond was filed the next June 22nd, 1988. Now, again, an extension of time for filing a cross bond on appeal may be granted by an appellate court upon filing the bond within 15 days of the due date for the cross bond and file a motion reasonably explaining the need for such an extension. The initial issue then, and one of the points of error upon which petitioner's writ of error was granted, was whether or not my explanation constituted a reasonable explanation. This court is well aware of the series of opinions and changes to the rules of procedure that led to this court issuing the standard for determining what constitutes a reasonable explanation, which was articulated in the Meshwert opinion. The court wrote, any plausible statement of circumstances indicating that the failure to file within the required period was not deliberate or intentional, but was a result of inadvertence, mistake, or mischance. As the court recalls, the reason for failing to file the record on appeal in that case was that the petitioner had miscalculated the proper filing date. Now, although this test envisions the type of reasons that the commentators refer to as bordering on negligence, there are accepted reasons which do not involve negligent behavior. For example, the initial one that comes to mind is the delays due to the court reporter. And I'd like to read a short passage from a law review article entitled Deadlines and Extension Motions in Civil Appellate Litigation, which was written by Mr. Timothy Patton and recently published in the St. Mary's Law Journal. Each month, appellate courts grant hundreds of motions for extension of time to file the statement of facts based upon affidavits by court reporters that they are busy with other official duties, such as their day-to-day attendance at judicial proceedings or the preparation of other statements of fact. While the court reporter's workload does not literally qualify as, quote, inadvertence, mistake, or mischance, as required by Meshwert, appellate courts uniformly accept the situation as a reasonable explanation for the necessity of an extension. He cites many cases to that effect. Additionally, delays attributable to the workload of the district clerk's office have been held to be reasonable explanations. And again, I'd like to take a moment to read from the decision which held this to be true. The court in that case wrote, in the case before us, the appellants requested the preparation of the transcript some 51 days after filing judgment. No motion for new trial was filed. However, in explaining the inability of the clerk to prepare the transcript by the 60th day, the appellants offer reasons showing the clerk was required to get out two transcripts, the original case and the bill of review, that the clerk had a busy schedule, and the clerk was short of personnel because of vacations. The court went on to write, we are of the opinion that the district clerk's inability to prepare the transcript in 9 days in and of itself would not be the fault of an attorney for the appellant if he had properly informed the district clerk of the deadline for filing in the Court of Civil Appeals. Appellant's attorney alleges that his own schedule has been very busy with civil and criminal trials, but he does not specifically state that his work was related to his failure to request a transcript more promptly. Although Rule 21C does not envision that just any explanation will be sufficient, we do hold that if the explanation explaining the cause for the failure of a party to timely file is reasonable, and such explanation comports with judicial experience, then the motion should be granted. We judges are familiar with the term, quote, reasonable. Court of Appeals then granted the extension. Now, I read this language because it was written by Justice Nye of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals in the case of Hildyard versus Fennell Studio, Inc. This is the same court, again, that issued the opinion for this court today.
Different path.
Excuse me?
Different patent. Just not without a patent.
Yes, except Justice Nye was not in the dissent in this case. Voted with the majority.
What was the Tim Patton Law Review citation?
Let me get that for you. St. Mary's Law Journal, Volume 20, Number 1, 1988. In one reported opinion, the fact that counsel for the appellant was under disabilities resulting from recent surgery was held to be a reasonable explanation, as it no doubt should be. Appellant's inability to find a willing surety and inability to pay for the statement of facts in advance, again, although technically not reasons based on inadvertence, mistake, or mischance, have been held to be reasonable explanations. All of these do not technically fall under the inadvertence, mistake, or mischance standard, but were all held to be reasonable explanations. I would submit to this honorable court, then, that there is ample precedent for granting extensions of time based upon reasonable explanations that do not technically derive from inadvertence, mistake, or mischance, as is the case for in the situation before you today. Now, let's look at some of the other reasons that have fallen into that category. Miscalculations of the due dates are uniformly held to be reasonable explanations, whether such miscalculations resulted from reading the wrong law or simply not being able to count days. This court, of course, has recognized that explanation in the Meshwood opinion. Filing in the district court rather than a court of appeals has been held to be a reasonable explanation. Using a different cause number on appeal when the clerk had inadvertently assigned two cause numbers was a reasonable explanation recognized by this court. I would submit that waiting until one has an opportunity to make a reasonable inquiry into whether one has reasonable grounds to pursue an appeal seems an eminently more reasonable explanation. If my reason, however, in and of itself does not constitute a reasonable explanation, then I submit that it was based upon a reasonable mistake of law, at least as reasonable a mistake as a miscalculation as to when a certain action had to be taken, based upon a reliance of a superseded rule of procedure. This court recently wrote, "We have long recognized that the right of access to an appellate tribunal is a valuable one, constitutionally protected against arbitrary or unreasonable abrogation." Now, words such as arbitrary or unreasonable are difficult to adequately define when I am dealing with at least four learned judges and able judges of the Court of Appeals who apparently disagree with me. But I can only argue to this court that my actions seem eminently more reasonable explanation than not being able to count days, or reading superseded law, or filing in the wrong court, or simply having other, more important work to do.
Do we have a standard problem? Do you think that this court should promulgate other standards besides reasonable excuse, or is this just a case-by-case basis, and this is one we ought to reverse?
The problem is, I believe, in the Meshwood opinion, you are dealing specifically with almost what constituted negligence. You know, the guy said, didn't count the days right, or I misread the law, whichever it was. Now, and you said, this court said, mistake, inadvertence, or mischance. But the case law has clearly shown that there are reasonable explanations that are not negligent. And possibly this is this court's opinion to extend that and say, yes, wait a minute, we talk negligence in these situations, but there are reasonable explanations that maybe do not constitute negligence. And I'm not saying that, and I assure the court, possibly I was negligent. Possibly I didn't understand the law correctly. But then that falls into a reasonable mistake of law. But I submit to this court that maybe your definition is too narrow, that negligence should not be the standard, that negligence or any other reasonable explanation bounded in reasonable work of reasonable attorneys should be the standard by which this is granted. I submit to you that the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals has a far narrower standard than that, far narrower standard. The second ground upon which this court granted the writ of error was that the Court of Appeals case in the Home Insurance Company versus Espinoza case is no longer good law and should be specifically overruled. Now, Justice Dorsey's dissent in this case, the Garcia case, joined in by Justice Seardon in this case, more than adequately explains why Espinoza is no longer sound law and should be specifically overruled. And basically, it conflicts with this court's holding in the Finland case, which are similar cases. The Thornton case, Thornton versus Finland Funeral Home. Thornton granted the extension on similar facts. Espinoza did not. Corpus Christi Court of Appeals seems to be continuing to follow the, quote, good cause standard. My time is up at this point.
Go ahead and finish your sentence.
All right. Which were specifically rejected by Meshwort, although Corpus Christi courts continue to cite Meshwort as its grounds for holding in these cases. Both the Dallas Court and Waco Court of Appeals have recently written opinions declining to follow Espinoza and criticizing its holdings. And I might add to this court that the Waco Court of Appeals has already stated that it will not follow the holding of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals in this particular case.
I have one question. Did you know this was going to be an en banc opinion? Did you argue before all six?
Yes. I believe there were six justices there that day. It was, no, I did not. We filed a motion. The court, on its own motion, granted an en banc hearing. It was the Wednesday before the Friday that the hurricane was supposed to hit in Corpus Christi. I was surprised that we argued at all. It was the first time I had argued a motion en banc to a court of appeals, and it was the first time I'd ever argued a motion on the court's on motion on oral arguments.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chairman. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
And please, the court, Mr. James Whitney, this is an argument for the respondent.
Please, the court, counsel. My name is Jim Whitten. I'm from Sinton. I represent the Kastners in this case, the respondents. I would like to respectfully read to the honorable court from the primary opinion relied upon by the petitioner in this case, that is the Heritage case, on page 232, where it says, under Meshwert, Strickland, and Sloan, the reasonable explanation required by Rule 41A2 focuses on a lack of deliberate or intentional failure to comply. And then the court goes on to say, anything short of deliberate or intentional noncompliance falls within the area of inadvertence, mistake, or mischance. Then the court goes on, consequently, we decline to follow Espinoza and overrule Byers' cross point. In this case, although it is not truly clear to me the petitioner's position all the way through its motions and all the way through its presentation in this case, sometimes when it suits the purposes of the petitioner argues that there is indeed a mistake. Sometimes when it suits the position of the petitioner argues that it was a deliberate decision because apparently, the petitioner's attorney simply did not agree with the requirements of Rule 41 of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure. The court, the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas, has shown that it knows how to extend deadlines automatically by the requirements and the leeway granted specifically in the rule regarding the filing of a motion for a new trial, extending the deadline for perfecting the appeal. The Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi is in situations such as this, analogous to the trial court. That is, it is the original forum for consideration of the issues raised in this proceeding. And I respectfully submit to the court that after reading all of the statement of facts, after considering the affidavit of the petitioner's attorney, after hearing the argument of both sides in this case, the Court of Appeals, the finder, so-called, or so to speak, of fact in this case, applied the law in this particular case and said that no reasonable explanation had been given. The standard then before this honorable Supreme Court is, did the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi in this particular case, after originally considering all the factors and all the facts and all the law, abuse its discretion in denying the right, the so-called right of the petitioner for the late filing of the cost bond on appeal? And I submit to the court that there is no shown abuse of discretion by the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi in this case.
What case establishes that our review is an abuse of discretion standard?
Frankly, Your Honor, I cannot cite a case to the court at this time. It is my understanding, based on the general knowledge of law, that when an original proceeding is brought up, or an original decision, such as this is on this issue, in a court of appeals or any inferior court, then that court has the obligation and the right to decide whether or not a reasonable explanation or any other criterion has been presented to the court, and that only when that court makes its decision using its discretion, if its discretion has been abused, may it be reversed on appeal.
Why is it the use of discretion?
Excuse me, sir?
I thought this wasn't a use of discretion on the court of appeals. We had a standard. dismiss work that they were to follow or not to follow?
Well, it's my understanding, Your Honor, that the Court of Appeals uses its discretion in reviewing the statement of facts and the presentation before it as to whether or not a reasonable explanation has been given. That is the standard, reasonable explanation. And the courts, the Supreme Court of Texas and the other inferior appellate courts have set forth decisions more defining that standard. The standard has been inadvertence, mistake, mischance to allow a miscalculation or something of that nature to warrant the late filing of the cost bond. Also an automatic extension in the rule itself if a motion for new trial is filed by any or all parties. However, in a situation such as this, I submit to the court that it's our position that it is on a case-by-case basis as to whether or not a reasonable explanation exists. And I think, and I submit to your honors that the petitioner in this case, when his argument before this court is boiled down to its essence, is simply saying that the petitioner simply didn't want to follow the rule, that he thought it would be better not to make the decision as to whether or not to appeal before he saw the findings of fact and conclusions of law. But that's nowhere in the rule, it's nowhere in the decisions that I've seen.
You agree it makes good sense to want to see the findings of fact and conclusions of law before you decide you want to appeal, doesn't it?
Well, I would submit to the court that if I were on the Supreme Court and making these rules, that I would use that as a possible criterion, as the court has done in extending the time automatically if a motion for a new trial is filed, to see what happens to the motion for a new trial. Yes, Your Honor.
I really didn't ask you. You were on the Supreme Court, what would you do? But would you, if you were the losing party, wouldn't you want to see the findings of fact and conclusions of law before you made a decision to post a cost bond and spend the money on appeal?
I would probably like to do that. However, I think in this case, the record shows that nothing that could have been in the findings of fact and conclusions of law would have been a revelation or a surprise or anything of that nature to the petitioner's attorney, as that very attorney participated in the trial of the case, knew the issues, formulated in large part the issues, and was there when the evidence was presented and the rulings of the court were promulgated.
Did you furnish the trial court with suggested findings and conclusions?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor, I did. Trial court asked me to do that, and I did that.
And did the trial court basically adopt those findings?
There were numerous changes, Your Honor, but yes, they were basically adopted.
And were the proposed findings and conclusions sent to the opposing counsel?
Ooh, I honestly don't recall that, Your Honor. I'm sorry. I would also like to point out to the court that appeals can be dismissed by the appellant at any time after an appeal is perfected. That we have these rules regarding, or laws regarding statutes of limitations. We have rules regarding when you must perfect your appeal if you're going to do that, when you must file the statement, when the statement of facts must be filed, when you must file your brief. And I think that that part of the public's perception on what I understand to be the public's complaint about never-ending legal processes should be addressed here, in that I believe that my client, the Kastners, the respondents in this case, have the right to have this case ended if the petitioner, the plaintiff in the trial court, doesn't follow the rules that apply to them through its attorney and to the other side. This case was ended by the failure to file the cost bond on appeal. No reasonable explanation has been given under the decisions, and I submit to the court that the judgment, the requirements put down and set down in this case, the denial of the finding of a reasonable explanation for a late filing of the cost bond of the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi should be affirmed.
The petitioner cites the Thornton versus Finland Funeral Home case extending or perhaps conflicting with Meshwort. What's your view of that?
I think that it, I believe, Your Honor, that the in that case, as in most cases, when these cases, the Court of Appeals take this action, and the Supreme Court is, the Honorable Supreme Court usually goes along with the Court of Appeals, I see no conflict in it at all. I think the decision-making power in this situation should be left in each specific case with the standards as they exist now, and the Court of Appeals has made its decision and did not abuse its discretion. Thank you.
I necessarily had just a few brief remarks since I essentially presented the argument of petitioner.
Why didn't you move for a mistrial, for a new trial?
Because I did honestly did not think it was necessary, and I thought it would be a total waste of time and effort.
Wouldn't that have solved this problem?
Obviously, it would have solved this problem, but the case was fully tried. There was no, even under that situation, I could have filed, in retrospect, yes. In taking an action that was not necessarily warranted, nor did I feel necessary, I could have filed for a motion for a new trial and theoretically extended this.
Basically,
I did not want a new trial. Basically, the issues were very clear. As far as I thought, the evidence had been presented to the court. And I believe, by the way, this court's holding in Thornton versus Finland Funeral Home basically addresses that and says, this court is not going to require attorneys to do things that are unnecessary. And I believe that's specifically stated in the Thornton Funeral Home.
So you think if you got the right findings of fact and conclusions of the law, you had a good appellate record to get a reversal rendition, whatever, on appeal?
At the time that I had the findings of fact, let me also say, you know, as I said, he said that it was very clear to me what the issues were. You've got to understand, the Court of Appeals, the trial court says, we're going to grant you this amount of material that you moved at this price. And, on the other side, by the way, they have this amount of offsetting damages. No explanation for those damages, and I wasn't even sure in the trial court where that came up. Number two is, the court said, you know, Mr. Murray's attorney's fees were X, Mr. Witten's attorney's fees were X, those are going to be offset. I'm not even sure that he had the right to do that. But given that all aside, the case had been fully tried. There was no, I didn't feel like there was any necessity for seeking a new trial at this case at this point. It was a matter if to be decided would have been decided by the Court of Appeals, and that's the proper place. But I still believe that there were methods by which the findings of fact and conclusions of law could have been drafted. I mean, in all honesty, that I would have had a real problem recommending an appeal of the case.
If the Court of Appeals reviewed the case and said, in this case, everybody was on full notice what the issues were and waiting for the findings and conclusions couldn't possibly have influenced the decision whether to appeal, would that be an appropriate case to say that waiting was not a reasonable explanation?
I still don't believe so. I don't think that should be the law, Justice Heck. I think the law should be an attorney will review the findings of fact and conclusions of law and make that as a minimum type of determination before he goes forward with an appeal. That he should have that minimally in hand, minimally review those before he makes a determination. Otherwise, I'm not sure that I understand what Rule 13 means. You know, yes, I tried the case. Yes, I went through the whole case. I heard all the evidence of the testimony. Yes, I disagreed with the judge's opinion. I've done that before. Obviously, I also disagreed with the Court of Appeals' opinion. But I believe that an attorney should minimally have that to review prior to making that determination to appeal. So, no, I don't think that should be the criteria.
Counsel, you were the plaintiff in the case, in a breach of contract case that you chose to try before the court.
Yes.
You obviously didn't convince the trial court that you should prevail because you ruled against you. I have a suspicion that perhaps your delay in filing the cost bond was perhaps had to do with perhaps your client not paying you the fee, which is usually the case.
No, Your Honor. In fact, After the decision of the court came out, my client is essentially insolvent, and I agreed to take the entire appeal on a pro bono basis. So I can assure you that that is not the case. I would also like to answer Justice Heck. Counsel did not tender me a copy of the proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. I did not see them. So I didn't know until today that he had drafted them. I assume
that was an ex parte communication between the trial court and counsel?
None at all.
It's not required. It's not required under the rules.
Yeah, absolutely none at all. I mean,
Live Oak County, where this was tried, what city?
It was actually tried in George. It started in George West. There was a substantial, as I say, the reason, by the way, there's a substantial, the record will show a lot of reasons why we originally asked for a jury, but finally on the day of trial, to avoid a subsequent delay, decided to go ahead and try it to the court. It was initially started in George West and terminated in Sinton, finally heard in Sinton, Texas.
And do you think the proper standard for this court's review of the Court of Appeals decision is abuse of discretion?
I don't think so. I don't think abuse of discretion. I'm not, my understanding is when this court promulgates a standard and also promulgates, affirms opinions by which those standards can be determined, then you have mandated to the Court of Appeals, this is what we expect you to do. To the extent that they're outside of that, I'm not sure it's a discretionary act.
Was there any live testimony or anything taken in the Court of Appeals that's not in the record? Does the Court of Appeals have any more information than we have in making this decision?
Other than the arguments that I've essentially presented the same thing today, there was nothing else. I would also like to address one other point before we get here. I have always, even in my affidavit, continued, I did what I honestly believe that this court mandated attorneys to do under Rule 13. But I specifically stated in my affidavit, if I have guessed wrong, then I am submitting to you that that is a reasonable mistake of law on which this is based. And subject to that, there have been numerous cases that have held that a reasonable mistake of law, even what would maybe call an unreasonable mistake of law, reading the wrong superseded law to determine what was the standard for counting the number of days by which it was done. But even to that extent, I've argued, I said, you know, I'm in between a rock and a hard place here. I believe that this court, under its rules of procedure, mandated that attorneys do that as a minimal requirement.
One final irrelevant question. Did you have to drive to Sinton to personally present the request for findings and conclusions to the judge?
I not only had to drive to Sinton to do that, I also had to physically drive to Sinton to hand the judge the reminder to make sure he signed it, since the rules on that require that merely presenting it to the court, filing with the court is not sufficient, it must be presented to the judge, which I might add tends to be an onerous burden in the state of Texas unless you practice in your hometown. Arguing for the Court of Appeals on the Wednesday before a hurricane was supposed to hit on Friday was also kind of exciting. But
well, we encourage pro bono work.
Also, just had one more final point. You said that Thornton Funeral Homes, I said that Thornton Funeral Homes conflicted with meshwork. That was not my statement, or if I stated that was not my intent. Thornton Funeral Homes conflicts with Espinoza, which is the Court of Appeals case. I would like to also submit to this court that all of the tough opinions in this area, as cited by the recent Waco Court of Appeals, they did a great job, they cited all the tough opinions come out of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals. And both the Dallas Court and the Waco Court have criticized this, saying that they are still going back to the older standard of either good cause or reasonable diligence and not the standard, the more relaxed standard that this Court of Appeals talked about in the Meshwood opinion, which again makes eminently more sense. I can think of nothing else in the very few things except statute of limitations where we make such an absolute didactic total, you're out of court if you don't do this by this time, without any reason of does this affect the other side, does it have an adverse effect on the counsel for the other side, was the party in any way prejudiced. This court, as I say, and I understand in reading the cases that this, in the dissents, that this was a compromise. Obviously, this can't go on forever. But this court, I believe the intention of this court is expressed in the cases, is expressed in the cases that this court has seen fit to affirm by NRA decisions, essentially, stated, we are looking for a reasonable explanation. And I would submit to the court that my explanation was reasonable. Thank you very much.
Before any causes are submitted on briefs and oral arguments, that concludes the business of the court for the day, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.